So, starting with a riddle, what do broken bonds, burnt boots, and a born baby have in common? The answer is they're the means by which God gives hope, greatness, and happiness. In Isaiah chapter 9, three great things are prophesied in the first three verses, followed by three causes in verses 4 through 6. There's a great light in Galilee, a great increase of the people of God, and a great happiness in the presence of God. And these are things that we associate with Christmas. Christmas lights, candles, light. Greatness and increase is something we also associate with Christmas. Filling the house with family and friends. Great Christmas sales. Great Christmas pageants. And happiness, of course. We enshrine that in our greetings. Merry Christmas. Joyous Noel. Happy holidays. Light. Greatness and happiness. We all want these things, especially at Christmas. How do we get them? The three causes of these things are the answer to the riddle. In Isaiah 9, each of these causes is introduced by the Hebrew word ki, which means for or because. And most English versions carry that through the beginning of verses 4 and 5 and 6. If you're following along in your own Bible, each of those start with the word for, unless you're looking at the NIV, which dropped out of verse 5. But it's there. First, the yoke of oppression has been dropped to the ground, totally come apart, and the oppressors are afraid to ever use it again. That's the picture we get from the verb ha-chitota in verse 4. Sorry, I'll get it right someday. The second reason is that the war will be over. Army boots and garments bloodied will be useless. That's the picture painted in verse 5. And then the third reason, because of the birth of a child, given as a gift to shoulder the burden of government and to reign as a king in peace for the rest of eternity. That's the picture that's presented in verses 6 and 7. Now, I hear and read this passage every Christmas, and it's pretty much old hat to me. I could probably recite it in my sleep. But it is such a rich passage, and its message is so staggering that it deserves better treatment. It deserves slow meditation on what it says about Jesus and what he's up to let it really sink in. And that's what I want to do in this sermon. Take this passage apart piece by piece and think about what it all means. It's probably going to take me two sermons to do this. I'll first unpack the three great promises today, and then maybe next Sunday unpack the three great reasons. These promises were not only for Isaiah's people some 3,000 years ago. They also apply to us today. Let's start then with the first great thing prophesied, and that is a great light. Isaiah 9:1, for there will be no gloom for her who was in distress. In the former time he caused to be lightly afflicted the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but later he's caused to be glorious the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of death's shadow, light has shined upon them. This is an amazing promise. Start out with, we've got some place names. Land of Zebulun and Naphtali. You can see where Zebulun is there in the map of Israel, and Naphtali up above it, Nazareth and Cana would be in Zebulun, Capernaum at the top of the Sea of Galilee was part of the tribe of Naphtali. Of course, the most easily distinguishable landmarks for Israel are your Dead Sea down at the south end across from Jerusalem, and then the Jordan River that runs north to south above it, and the Sea of Galilee up at the north end of the Jordan River. This was a trunk highway for people going between Egypt and the Istans, we might call them, or Syria and further north. There's a highway that ran like that along the flat lands of the coast of the Mediterranean, and then went up through the pass of Megiddo across the plain there, cutting over to the top of the Sea of Galilee, and then on up north into Damascus. But there was a spur that ran right next to the Sea of Galilee and connected there at the Megiddo Pass. And this is the, it was called the Via Maris, the way by the sea. And at that point, the Sea of Galilee was just a lake, like our lakes on each side of Manhattan here. But it's but they called it sea. They didn't have a separate word for that. So it's interesting. This is the words that Isaiah used, speaking of the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, up above the Jordan there, land of Naphtali and Zebulun. This is exactly the area where Jesus began his ministry. Jesus did his first recorded miracle in this area. He did his first public preaching in this area. He traveled up and down that Via Maris many times with his disciples and sent his disciples preaching in that area, Galilee of the nations. Now, Isaiah says that historically this region had been under distress and anguish or vexed, and then afflicted and humbled and brought under contempt. What's he referring to here? In about 200 years before Isaiah's prophecy, Galilee had been hit hard by Ben-Hadad, king of Syria. 1 Kings 15 describes that. He sent the captains of his armies against the cities of Israel, and he attacked all the land of Naphtali. The foreign army of Syria had already distressed them. Then, closer to the time of Isaiah, Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria had conquered the whole region and deported the people of the Jews out of it. 2 Kings 15 describes that. In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and took Galilee and all the land of Naphtali and carried them away captive to Assyria. And then after the Assyrian deportation, it was colonized by pagans from the surrounding nations through the Tiglath-Pileser's successor, Esarhaddon. And 2 Kings 17 describes that. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and dwelt in its cities. Galilee of the Gentiles. And then this region became the first to receive the light from the Messiah. Matthew highlights that. In chapter 4, after leaving Nazareth, Jesus came to reside in Capernaum in the seaside areas of Zebulun and Naphtali, in order that the word through Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled. Land of Zebulun and land of Naphtali, way by the sea, alongside the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people sitting in darkness saw a great light. And for those who were sitting in the boondocks of the shadow of death, light rose for them. This people on whom the light rose would have been the people of God. In Isaiah's time, the Jews. They're described as walking in darkness and in living in a land of deep shadow, the shadow of death, darkness. They're walking through the valley of the shadow of death, being hit by rods and staffs of their oppressors, the Assyrians and Syrians, because they rebelled against God. If they had walked with God, with God's rod and staff helping them, they could have instead said with David in Psalm 23, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." But they had left the paths of righteousness. Proverbs 2:13 says, "When you leave the paths of righteousness, you walk in darkness." And that's what the Jews of Isaiah's day were doing. At the end of chapter 8, just before chapter 9, Isaiah had said, if they don't speak according to this word, the law and the testimony, then that one has no dawn. And he shall pass through hard-pressed and hungry and be frustrated and curse. And he'll look to the earth and behold distress and darkness and the gloom of anguish thrust into thick darkness. Later on in chapter 59, Isaiah expounded further this walking in darkness. Isaiah 59:7, "Their feet run to evil. They hasten to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity, and the way of peace they have not known. And there's no justice in their ruts. Their paths they have made crooked for themselves, and all who tread in it have not known peace. Therefore justice has been far from us, and righteousness does not reach us. We wait for the light, and look, there's darkness. For brightness, but in the gloom we walk. We grope along the wall like the blind. We grope as though we had no eyes. We have stumbled in midday like twilight, with the stout men like the dying men. We wait for justice, but there is none. For salvation, but it's far from us. For our rebellions have become many before you, and our sins have testified against us. For our rebellions are with us, and for our iniquities we know them." Rebellion, being untrue with Jehovah, turning back from following our God, speaking injury and revolt, conceiving and uttering from the heart words of falsehood. Sounds a lot like the land we live in today too, doesn't it? God punished Judah for their rebellion by allowing the Babylonian army to come and conquer them and take them into exile. In Lamentations 3, the prophet Jeremiah described the time of the exile of the Jews in Babylon as walking in darkness. And in Psalm 107, it also describes that the time of exile was like the shadow of death. And then for 400 years, God was silent. No word from God, no prophet, no revelation for four centuries while the Jews are oppressed by the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans. Now that was God's specific punishment for the Jews of Isaiah's day. But what about us? When we and our people, the people in, among whom we live, followed the same path away from God in darkness. This is not limited to the Jews of Isaiah's day. It applies to all of us because the Bible equates the shadow of death, that deep darkness, with death itself. Death is something every human being faces. Death is the result of transgressing God's law. We've all transgressed God's law. And so we all, as sinners, live in the shadow of death, knowing we must die and face God's judgment. And sinners have no future hope, no light at the end of the tunnel. The reality of the hopelessness and darkness of our human condition and our abandonment of God and His ways is what makes this prophecy so startling and wonderful. There will be no more gloom. Instead, there will be glory, great light, shining light. Psalm 136:7 is the only other passage in the Bible that mentions great light, and that is referring to the suns and moons. Ever since the time change this fall, my morning prayer walks have been swathed in darkness. A couple of weeks ago, when the moon was not visible, I walked past some of my teenage neighbors who were standing on the street corner in the early morning darkness waiting for the school bus. They were really cool, and they all had their earbuds in, so they didn't hear me coming. And then when I suddenly loomed out of the mist before their eyes, they kind of lost their cool. But on mornings when the moon is full, you can see things pretty well. You can even see shadows. But then when the sun rises and all its glory of nuclear fusion, I can see everything brightly, sharply, in color. The light of God shines down on us. It's not the light of a pier that shines across from us. We need the light of God that shines down on us. The mercury vapor lights at the end of the reception hall where we had Brian and Grace's wedding, the lights at the end were broken. And so it was really dark back there as we were setting up, and I was trying to figure out, how do I light this area? And the best I was able to find was a halogen shop lamp mounted on a stand. So I put that on one side, and then I remembered I had a gas lantern. So I put that on the other side. And so if you were there, the light was shining from the sides, but not from above back there. And it was still gloomy. I'm not sure how the kids enjoyed playing back there. It was dark and gloomy back there. For light to have its full effect, it needs to be above and shining down. And that's what God's light does. The last place we saw that Hebrew word for light shining was in Psalm 18:28, where it says, "You cause my lamp to beam. The Lord my God causes my darkness to shine." This is where our light comes from. God caused a light to shine. The light comes from God. This is a development from Job's negative corollary, that the light of the wicked goes out and the flame of his fire does not shine. Light doesn't come from man. It comes from God. And specifically, dawned in Jesus. Malachi prophesied that. "But to you who fear my name, the sun," that's S-U-N, "of righteousness shall arise with healing in his wings," speaking of Jesus. When Jesus came, he said, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life." And John testified to that too. He was the true light, which upon coming into the world gives light to every man. The replacement of darkness with a great light, the first great promise, is itself a breaking of bondage and a winning of the war. Its fulfillment was inaugurated in the birth of Jesus. Now we move on to the second great promise, a great increase. You've caused the nation to multiply. About a millennium before Isaiah wrote his book, God spoke to a man and his wife who were sterile, on the verge of dying and passing out of memory and handing over all their possessions to their slaves because they had no children. The Lord said to Abram, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you, and I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing." Throughout history, even to the present day, the Jewish people have constantly seemed to be on the verge of becoming extinct, threatened by one genocide after another, from Haman to Hitler to Ahmadinejad. The Jews of Isaiah's day too were facing extinction as the Assyrians had wiped out the northern kingdom and were attempting to wipe out Jerusalem and Judea as well. The population was dwindling. Isaiah in chapter 4 prophesied of a time when there'd be so few men that women would gladly pursue polygamy. When Jesus then came to Nazareth, it was also to a small and threatened Jewish population. It was a Jewish outpost, a Jewish town, Nazareth, surrounded by Gentiles. And the Jews there saw themselves as a minority, struggling to exist in the midst of a Gentile population. So a great increase in the nation's population, that's a big deal. And by the way, a country's greatest resource is its people. Don't forget that. But how would a vast increase come about with such a tiny nation, such a tiny family? Well, the New Testament makes clear what the Old Testament hinted at. By grafting in Gentiles to the people of God, Jesus caused the people of God to have a population explosion. Isaiah used the word goy to describe the nation or the people of God. If you've ever heard Jewish people speak in an insulting way about Gentiles, they call them goy. But it's the goy who will be increased, said Isaiah. Jesus told his disciples in Matthew 12 that he had come to fulfill the prophecy in Isaiah 42 that he will announce justice to the Gentiles. And in his name, Gentiles will hope. The Apostle Paul understood this. He summed it up as he preached the gospel throughout the world, that Jesus opened the door of faith to the Gentiles. The population floodgate for God's people was thrown open by Jesus. By 100 AD, there were Christians in every province of Rome. And it's estimated that by the 300s AD, some 20% of the world's population identified with Christianity. And it has stayed around that percentage ever since. That percentage, I mean, the numbers now, close to 2 billion that would identify themselves as Christians. Now, of course, it's inflated with a lot of people who are just Christians in name only, but it's still a mind-boggling growth of the people of God. A great light a great increase that was designed to include us. And now the third promise, a great joy. In our reading, the wise men rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Isaiah said in verse 3, you've caused its joy to increase. They rejoice before your faces with joy at harvest, like those who are happy when they divide spoil. My kids don't look all that happy in that picture on the screen, but they've just harvested our potatoes that are in the bucket there and are carrying them in triumphantly. Now, the first thing to get out of the way here is the King James reading, which says, not increased the joy. All the other English translations, including the American Jewish translation and the New King James, which corrects the King James, read, you shall, or you have, or you do increase their joy or gladness. And the explanation is that in Hebrew, the word lo can be spelled two different ways, actually three, because the Dead Sea Scroll spell it a third way. But you hear the word lo, it could mean not, or it could mean to him or to it. The spelling usually can indicate which it means, whether it means not or whether it means to it. But the spelling of the Masoretic text of Isaiah, which the King James translators used, is irregular here. And they decided to go with the Roman Vulgate interpretation of it rather than with the Greek Septuagint interpretation of it. I've underlined the word in question in each of the translations on the screen texts. Modern translators, since 1950, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, or at least the Isaiah Scroll was discovered, have the benefit of also comparing this with a document written in Hebrew 1,000 years before the oldest known Masoretic Hebrew manuscript. And the reading of the Dead Sea Scroll of Isaiah supports the Septuagint, belonging to it, or in the Septuagint, in you, literally, but it's clearly not a negative in the Septuagint. There's no reason to throw away the Vulgate or the King James. It's still true there were times when God did not cause the joy of his people to increase. But, when we do adequate research, we see Isaiah speaking most likely of a time when God is increasing the joy of his people. A lesson learned from this is that it is valuable to look at multiple translations at the same time, or even learn Hebrew, in order to get a fuller understanding of what God's Word does or does not say. But these people, the point is, these people are transformed from an experience of gloom to an experience of increasing happiness. And the happiness is described with two similes, like the joy of harvest time. When harvesting's going on, people can see an entire year's supply of grain or fruit or whatever. Looks like a lot of food. There's abundance, there's feasting, there's sharing. You know, you're never going to be hungry at harvest time. In the fall, when the fruits are ripe on all the apple and pear trees in our neighborhood, my family gets permission to pick fruit off of our neighbor's trees. And we come home always with bushels and bushels of apples or pears pictured up there on the screen, usually more than we can process before they go rotten. And we're eating fresh-picked apples and make apple pies and apple crisp and fried apples and press apple cider, freezing apples for cooking later. And if you come by our house at that time of year, you're likely to get desserts made of apples and be offered apples to take home with you. The kind of joy that stems from abundant provision ends the fear of suffering, want, oppression, and war. unstable government create situations where people's economic abundance is squashed. Extortion, theft, inflation, high taxes, that removes a nation's happiness and replaces it with anxiety. And God promises to bring an end to these kind of uncertainties and injustices through broken bonds, burnt boots, and a born baby. And that's good news. The second simile is like those who are happy when they defied spoil. And that's a picture of military victory. We don't see much of that nowadays in our country unless you're stationed on Fort Riley about to get deployed. And for the rest of us, probably the most closest we come to that is when we go to a football game or a basketball game and your team has just taken the lead at the end of the game and everybody's up on their feet cheering and jumping up and down and the buzzer goes off and your team has just beat their long-standing rival. And the celebration goes on for hours. People rehearse the exciting conclusion over their coffee breaks for days afterwards. It's a kind of joy that stems from the defeat of an enemy. God says that He brings happiness to match what we feel when we're freed from threats and are living in abundance. One other thing, it talks about spoiling, dividing spoil. One of the experiences that people have when they divided spoil was that they recovered lost valuables that the enemy had stolen during raids. Hey, look, there's Grandma's silver spoon set. That's been in the family for 200 years. Glad we got that back. There's a special joy and triumph in recovering what has been stolen from us. Spiritually, our enemy, the devil, has stolen a great deal of happiness from us by luring Eve into eating the forbidden fruit and luring each one of us away from walking with God. The joy we will experience when Jesus' victory over Satan is consummated and Jesus hands back to us all that innocence, all that intimacy, all that intrepidness that we lost because of our sin, it's going to be sweet. So how do we get that kind of happiness? Notice where they are in order to experience that level of happiness. They are rejoicing where? In God's presence, before His face, literally. You want to experience happiness? Get into God's presence. He's the source of happiness. How do you get into God's presence? Well, that's the thing. You can't. You can't as long as you have any disobedience to His laws on record. Sin causes us to fall short of the glory of God. We can't enter God's presence because God doesn't tolerate sin. And we've all sinned. The only way we can get into the presence of God to experience His happiness is through Jesus. The Apostle Paul explained it this way. And you, being dead in your trespasses and in the uncircumcision of your flesh, He has made alive together with Him, having forgiven you all trespasses, having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which was contrary to us. He's taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. Having disarmed principalities and powers, He made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it. Talk about the happiness of divvying up that spoil. Well, I have to stop here and say for next week the three things that bring this prophecy to fulfillment: the broken bonds, the burnt boots, and the born baby. But of course, I've already been hinting at these things already in the exposition of the three great promises. I hope you're already seeing how important it is for Jesus to be born as a baby in order to give us the light of hope and the greatness of being His people and the happiness of being with God. 11 years ago, I was reading a passage from the end of Isaiah to my family during devotions. And I asked them, "So, where is our hope?" And a little voice piped up from Paula's lap, "Here." I looked over to see my youngest daughter, whose name is Hope, raising her hand because she'd heard her name called. But actually, our hope is in Jesus Christ. Will you focus your attention upon Him this Christmas? Will you put all your hope upon Him? As Robert Southwell put it in the conclusion of his famous Christmas poem, "If thou wilt foil thy foes with joy, then flit not from this heavenly boy." But I'm not going to read his whole poem like I have done in some years past. I found another poem that I find equally moving. It's called "The Babe and the Bride" by my son Amos, that I want to read in closing. Connection of the saints and me, who Abraham too longed to see, his birth in time, eternity, the finite in infinity, the word ineffable to say, this inexplicable display, the past and future dawn this day, here born in filth and bloody hay. His birth and dying, hell to shake, all bonds but bonds of love to break. This maker babe all earth remakes. The infant kings would kill, defame, the whole world's sins to him be blamed. This helpless is the help I claim. Immortal, mortal, Christ the same. This child's crooning, his curled hand would be disjointed for the damned. These kicking feet, untaught to stand, were shattered, splinted, iron slammed. The astral king here laid in straw, cursed to a cross and raging raw. Yes, at his form the devil's claw, but at his cry they shrink in awe. His natal bed he trades for stone. His dying breath for sin atones. His crying breaths are trumpets blown, and heaven's hosts for him have shone. Oh, precious babe, your weeping side would wounds of woe and spears divide. Yet hell is damned and death has died. Washed in the blood, I'm born your bride. Amen.